Mr. Cooper, one of the things you talk about in your fascinating book is about FEMA, and not only what all of us have heard about, that FEMA was a very much stripped back agency by the time Hurricane Katrina hit, but also the fact that it was hobbled in a sense by being a two-headed agency, as you put it. Tell us a little bit about that rift in FEMA and what impact that had on its response to Katrina.
Well, Greg, FEMA was invented by Jimmy Carter, and it worked for a time, and then under Reagan it worked less well, and under the first president, Bush, it worked even less well. I think people will remember Hurricane Andrew, people wandering around in the streets, not having food or shelter for days. So, you know, after 9/11, well, let me back up. Clinton brought FEMA up to a cabinet-level position where his man, James Lee Witt, could call him and say, I need 17 airplanes in Miami tomorrow, and those airplanes would arrive. After 9/11, FEMA was subsumed into this big, sprawling agency called the Department of Homeland Security, where it's one of the smallest agencies. And so now there are these layers of bureaucracy over FEMA, which hinders its ability to respond.
Well, and the fact that it is split, in a sense, as you said, even in almost personality, between the natural disaster folks and the national security folks, that they, at least at certain points, have seemed to really be at loggerheads with one another.
That's right. I mean, you know, I don't want to put too fine of a point on it, but, you know, terrorist events are for the big boys, and responding to disasters are for the girls. You know, let Brownie handle that. I mean, it's just a hurricane, right?
One of the most interesting things about your book is you help us understand why the people who acted in Katrina's wake, why they acted the way that they did. And in particular, one of the most interesting figures is this Matthew Broderick, not the actor, of course, but someone right in the thick of this disaster response. And you try to help us understand why he was so hesitant to set certain wheels in motion. Explain to our listeners who Matthew Broderick was and this hesitancy, which I'm talking about, which might have been appropriate on the battlefield, but not in this situation.
Matthew Broderick is the consummate military man. He's been involved in military events around the world, including, you know, Saigon and Mogadishu and places like that. He's interested in what he calls ground truth. In the fog of war, he needs to make sure that the information that he's getting and passing on to his superiors, like Chertoff and Bush, is absolutely accurate. What he fails to understand is that a disaster is a little different from a war. Sending troops blindly into a combat zone may result in lost lives. Sending extra food and water and helicopters into a disaster zone would likely do the opposite. And it just, you know, it never dawned on him that these were different.
And so he ends up being focused on trying to round up small little details at the expense of the big picture.
That's right. He decides that, okay, the definition of mega disaster in New Orleans is going to be whether the levees fell down or whether water just came over the top of them. If water just came over the top, theoretically they could just be pumped back out and it wouldn't be a big disaster. So he spent 30 hours trying to determine whether the levee walls had fallen down and water was cascading into the city, or whether the levees had simply topped. And that's 30 hours. That put them 30 hours behind, and it took them a week to catch up.
Hmm. You mentioned this fact of exactly when the levees were in fact breached, in fact compromised, and you suggest a fair amount of evidence that in fact this breaching of the levees may have begun to occur even before Katrina really hit.
The levees failed below their design rated strength. People think of Katrina as a massive storm, and it was, but Katrina hit Mississippi. Top sustained winds in New Orleans were roughly 85 to 100 miles an hour, which is a very small hurricane level storm. The levees broke under a storm surge that was around 8 or 9 feet. These levees should have been able to handle 11 feet, but they fell down anyway. And these are not levees built by locals. They're levees that are built under the supervision of the federal government, and they collapsed.
In the wake of course, what was a terrible disaster, you talk about three very basic needs which New Orleans needed from FEMA, food and water, reliable communications, and buses for evacuation. You outlined for us how FEMA was not able to provide any of those in any sort of meaningful fashion.
Well, FEMA didn't prepare very well for this. They knew what was going to happen. They had studied it. And even before the storm, people inside of FEMA who know what they're doing were saying, we don't have enough stuff pre-positioned in place. We have one day of food and water, and we have 50 generators when we should have 200 generators. After that, when they did realize how big it was, their guy who's asking for stuff is Michael Brown, who's a mid-level bureaucrat asking agencies like the Pentagon, can I have some airplanes to get some extra reinforcements here? The Pentagon's response is, you know, who are you? Why don't you get somebody with real authority to call us? Rumsfeld is in San Diego, so we can't help you.
In the wake of FEMA's widespread failure, you talk actually about how much of the rescue and recovery effort was actually maybe more effective than we realize. This incredible improvised effort on the ground, and much of that from regular citizens, it makes it kind of a strange story, doesn't it? I mean, failure on the one hand, a surprising amount of success achieved in spite of that.
It does, though. I'd qualify the success to some extent, and because there is no unified command, there's no single person in charge. Everybody's going out, dropping boats in the water, and going and rescue people. They bring these people back to dry land. They don't have any water or food to give them, and they go back out into the water. So the people on dry land who've been sitting on their roofs all day and they're thirsty and they're hungry begin to wander around the city looking for food and water. There's no FEMA food and there's no FEMA water, so they start breaking into stores to get food and water. And that caused a big problem. I mean, at one point there were 50,000 people wandering around the dry streets of New Orleans.
A last quick question. Among the many fascinating stories that are part of your book is the idea of loyalty trumping honesty. I think you're talking about that in reference to the importance of good information being shared by the people who most needed it. And somehow that did not happen, especially at the highest levels.
No, I mean, there's this fallacy that the federal government had no idea what was going on in the city of New Orleans, and that's just not the case. I mean, the information was stovepiped, and it was suppressed, and the people who really needed it, like the president and Mr. Chertoff, didn't get it in time.
And why would it have been suppressed?
Well, I mean, it goes back to Matthew Broderick. He decided that the most important thing was to provide 100% accurate information, and stuff that might not be completely accurate, he simply didn't pass on. And it's impossible to nail down every little detail of what's going on in New Orleans, even if you do know the big picture. And he certainly knew the big picture.
The book, again, is called Disaster, Hurricane Katrina, and the Failure of Homeland Security, published by Times Book, Henry and Holt. Christopher Cooper, one of the two authors. Christopher Cooper, I thank you for writing such a fascinating book.
Thanks a lot, Greg.